Thanks for tuning in for the March 2nd podcast. I'm Jose Merino, Editor-in-Chief of the Neurology family of journals, Neurology, Neurology Genetics, Neurology Neuroimmunology and Neuroinflammation, and Neurology Clinical Practice. In our first What's Trending segment, you'll hear from Dr. Eric Musiek about possible consequences of the FDA approval of a disease-modifying therapy for Alzheimer's disease. In this week's feature interview, Dr. Fana Alemsaged talks about the rate of reperfusion achieved when tenecteplase or alteplase are used before endovascular therapy for basilar artery occlusion.
Hey, this is Jason Crowell from Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. And for our What's Trending segment today, we have Eric Musiek joining us. Eric is a neurologist at Washington University in St. Louis, and we asked him to join us today to discuss his recent Viewpoint article in JAMA Neurology published on November 30th that he co-wrote with his colleague John Morris. The title of this piece is Possible Consequences of the Approval of a Disease-Modifying Therapy for Alzheimer's Disease. Eric, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Jason, for having me.
So we're going to be talking about how a disease-modifying treatment for Alzheimer's disease would change both clinical practice and ongoing research of Alzheimer's disease. But first, could you provide us with some context? So specifically, why are we having this conversation to begin with? How close are we to having a disease-modifying treatment?
Well, that's a complicated question, it turns out. There is one drug, aducanumab, that's being considered by the FDA right now. They are supposed to have an answer on approval by March 5th. So it's possible that we could have a drug available within a couple months of right now, which is very soon. That is a complicated issue in and of itself, whether or not they're going to approve that drug. But even if that drug is not approved, it's possible that same drug could get approved at a later date if they demand more data. Or there are several other drugs sort of right on the tail of aducanumab, such as BAN2401 and gantenerumab. So these are other anti-amyloid antibodies that are also in late-stage clinical trials that could be potentially in the approval tract very shortly.
Terrific. So let's suppose that either this drug you singled out or one of these drugs is approved by the FDA and enters the market. What would this do to our current healthcare system at a population level in terms of demand for neurologists or imaging studies? How might we need to change our clinical workflow if this were to happen?
Well, I think as it stands right now, there are certainly a lot of older Americans, and there's always more. The main risk factor for Alzheimer's disease is age. So I think as it stands right now, there is not the infrastructure available to provide this drug to everyone in a timely manner. And I think that's part of why we here at WashU were concerned about this issue, about how we were going to roll out such a drug if it were approved in a quick time frame, when we already have very high demand for our services. So there are a limited number of kind of dedicated memory disorders practices or dementia practices around the country. They tend to be at major academic centers. There are not a lot of private practice memory centers. And these centers in general, such as ours, already have long wait lists to see patients. So we feel like we're kind of just seeing the tip of the iceberg, motivated patients, patients that have unusual symptoms, that there are many, many others out there who potentially would seek this kind of drug. And so a major concern, that we had was that there would be a rush of people if such a drug were approved and it was on the news and in the lay media advertising this, which I'm sure would be advertised as a cure for Alzheimer's or breakthrough, that there could be this enormous demand to be, first of all, diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease formally, to undergo kind of more detailed analysis, such as biomarker studies, to get a firm diagnosis. And then ultimately for eligible patients to go on an antibody that requires, fairly regular infusions, follow-up MRIs. And so there's a lot that this entails. I think as it currently stands, we don't really have the infrastructure to do this in our memory clinics. So we discussed in the Viewpoint about how this will probably, if this is going to happen quickly, it's going to fall on not only on memory centers, but on general neurologists, on primary care doctors, geriatricians, sort of a network of physicians across many different subspecialties and even generalists to sort of do some parts of this workup. And that will require some additional training and changes to be made to some of the things we do currently.
Terrific. So if it is aducanumab that is the first to be approved, and of course we don't know that for sure yet, but what type of patients would be eligible for this drug and what kind of problems might that pose?
Well, I think that gets to the crux of the issue, is that the way that these clinical trials were conducted for aducanumab and for some of these other meds that are in the pipeline, they are really treating very mild Alzheimer's disease. So people that have a clinical dementia rating of 0.5, which is considered very mild, and have a mini mental status score of greater than 24 was the criteria used for aducanumab. So this is a subset of patients. And these patients also, these participants, when they're enrolled in this trial, they also had amyloid imaging. So they had amyloid PET done to confirm their plaque status, which is not something that is done kind of regularly in clinical practice currently, although it is FDA approved. So this creates a kind of two populations of people that may be, assuming that the drug is approved specifically for this type of patients, which I think is likely because similar drugs have failed in more severe patients in other clinical trials. So assuming that the FDA approves the drug and that insurance companies or CMS says that the drug is only available to people with mild Alzheimer's disease that have positive biomarkers, that's really a small subset of the total population of people that have either dementia or memory concerns. So there are kind of two populations that'll be sort of left out by a drug like this, at least initially, potentially. One is people that have more severe disease. And this is, you know, in most patients that we have that carry a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease are probably, many of them are already more severe than this drug would be appropriate for. So that is going to be a difficult situation. Certainly, I have many patients in my own practice that have been waiting, you know, for a drug and praying for a drug to be available to help them. And those will be some difficult conversations if some of these people have progressed too far for this drug to be appropriate for them and to be effective. I think if that expectation is not managed properly, it can create some situations that are difficult for providers and for patients to understand why, you know, they're not able to get this new exciting therapy. And I think that some of the need for that is that we have to make that clear at the beginning, if the drug is approved, that national organizations, you know, like the American Academy of Neurology or CMS or drug companies themselves need to make it clear that this, you know, drug is not a cure for everyone with Alzheimer's, but rather for this a small subset of people. I also think that there is a concern about the other group of people, which is people that have very mild symptoms or no symptoms, but maybe have positive biomarkers. So biomarkers for Alzheimer's disease, I mean, there's spinal fluid biomarkers, there's imaging, amyloid imaging that I referred to a moment ago. There's now blood biomarkers that are becoming available. These are becoming more available to people, and they are commonly used in our research studies. And so, you know, as there are more and more older Americans who have maybe a small memory problem that doesn't impact their life severely enough to be considered, you know, dementia or mild cognitive impairment, but they happen to have been in a study or have gotten biomarkers somewhere along the way, there's going to be a tremendous incentive for these people to get this drug. And so it's going to create a situation where, from both a research standpoint as well as from a clinical standpoint, we have to decide how we deal with that. And I think that creates some complications as these biomarker studies become more kind of available in general.
Yeah, I don't want to make this controversial, but if I understand you right, then I can imagine a patient who might have some kind of biomarker study that's abnormal and suggests they're going to develop Alzheimer's disease, who may not have symptoms yet, but they know that to get this new drug, they would need symptoms. And so you can almost imagine this kind of perverse incentive to develop cognitive symptoms to get the drug and have it approved. Am I understanding that right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. Yes, that's maybe an extreme version. But, you know, the diagnosis, the clinical dementia rating, the diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease, there's subjectivity involved. You know, it's not a clear-cut thing. And so even in the hands of people that do this every day, such as people at our center, there's still debate about if patients, you know, if they have some mild memory problems, does this meet the level of really being impairment versus just a subjective memory complaint? You know, if it's difficult for memory specialists, it's going to be very difficult for a primary care doctor who has to see 50 patients a day, you know, to spend 20 minutes talking about memory problem with a patient. So of course, if you know, any patient who has, you know, some concerns about their own memory, which is most of the patients we see, and maybe has some knowledge of their own biomarkers, or that they have an ApoE allele, or even if they just have a family history, there is some, you know, there's going to be some incentive for them to maybe overestimate their own memory problems such that they, you know, meet these criteria. So that is something that we have to keep an eye out for, I think. You know, and it also points to this issue of demand. You know, if demand is so great that we have people being diagnosed by a huge different array of specialists, that we need to have some sort of consistent diagnostic criteria that is relatively straightforward that people can use, so that they, you know, there isn't a lot of heterogeneity in who's, you know, considered eligible for this and who's not.
Yeah, that makes sense. So I'd like to ask you a research question in terms of implications. So I assume that if a disease-modifying treatment is available, almost all patients eligible for that treatment who are currently enrolled in, say, observational studies would elect to opt out and receive this new drug. So what effects do you see this potentially having on clinical research of Alzheimer's disease?
Well, I think certainly observational studies would have to change to account for this. You know, if one of these drugs is approved and that becomes the standard of care, then, you know, Alzheimer's enters into the world of other diseases like MS, where we have drugs, you know, and most patients are on the standard of care medication, and, you know, you have to show efficacy above and beyond that. So I think that the structure of a lot of our observational studies will have to change, in that as patients become symptomatic, many of them will probably choose to go on these drugs, and thus they won't be able to be followed in terms of natural history anymore. However, it will create a whole new set of questions, such as who responds to the drug well, you know, what factors dictate future success of the drug, developing, you know, additional adjunct therapies to go along with this therapy. So I don't think it will, you know, destroy clinical research by any means, but it will just change sort of the way we do things. I think one of the challenges will be, again, with this preclinical disease. So for instance, at our center, many of our participants are followed longitudinally, and many of them have no memory symptoms at all, but they're getting biomarkers done, spinal fluid, amyloid imaging, whatnot. And there's a lot of debate in the field about whether or not those biomarker data should be shared with the patient. And at this point, since there has been no disease-modifying drug available, you know, it's still ethical not to share all of this data with the patients if they have no symptoms. But the ethics of that, I'm certainly not an ethicist, but it will become murkier when a drug is available. So at what point, if you have a patient who is still considered to be cognitively normal, but you know they have plaques, or, you know, then where, at what point do you have the, you know, are you required to tell them that or to put them on a drug? And so that will push forward this conversation about the sharing of biomarker data with participants who are asymptomatic.
Great. So one last question for you here. I heard you say earlier about the potential need to increase training, you know, in terms of diagnosing patients with Alzheimer's disease. Is there anything we should be doing now, either as individual neurologists or as a community of neurologists in our own practices, to prepare for this happening, hopefully in the near future?
In general, I think if I were a general neurologist right now, I would want to stay up to date on what's going on with this, because certainly, you know, you could potentially have a crush of patients in a few months that are looking for, you know, the cutting edge Alzheimer's diagnostics. So I think we need to have, as a community, maybe more training in Alzheimer's disease biomarkers and when they're appropriate and when they're not. Probably some training in differentiating Alzheimer's disease from other neurodegenerative diseases. So, you know, a concern that we have in our center that we've been talking about is mixed dementias. So many patients may have Alzheimer's pathology, and if you just sent everyone with a memory concern off to get a PET scan, you're going to have a lot of patients, probably 30% of your patients over the age of 65 will have a positive scan. That doesn't necessarily mean that their symptoms are being caused by Alzheimer's disease. You can also have Lewy body dementia. You can always have other forms of dementia that are coexistent. So being able to, you know, identify other forms of dementia and rule that out. Now, it's still unclear exactly how that will figure into the use of this drug. So for instance, if you have a patient that has some symptoms of Alzheimer's disease, but also has, say, visual hallucinations or Parkinsonism or another symptom that may suggest a, you know, a coexistent or degenerative process, you know, and they have a positive amyloid PET, are they going to be eligible for this drug? I don't think that that's been decided yet. So there's a lot of unknown things. But I think that the more that the general neurology community is comfortable with the diagnosis and differential diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease and comfortable with the current state of the art biomarkers, which are generally not used very extensively outside of practices like our own, which are, you know, dedicated memory practices. And even we do not use them in most of our patients. It's in kind of a subset. So I think familiarity with these things will be important, not only for neurologists, but probably for practitioners and geriatricians and psychiatrists and everyone else.
Great. Well, again, to our audience, I encourage you to check out Eric's piece that he wrote with his colleague, John Morris. It was published November 30th in JAMA Neurology. Again, it's titled Possible Consequences of the Approval of a Disease-Modifying Therapy for Alzheimer's Disease. Eric, thanks so much again for taking a few minutes to talk with us today. Really appreciate it.
Great. Thank you, Jason.
Hello, this is Andy Sutherland from the University of Virginia. And for this week's neurology podcast, I have the pleasure to be speaking with Dr. Fana Amasaged from the Royal Melbourne Hospital and University of Melbourne in Parkville, Australia. We're going to be discussing her paper titled Tenecteplase versus Alteplase before endovascular therapy in basilar artery occlusion. In this paper, Fana and colleagues performed a retrospective analysis of the effectiveness of IV tenecteplase, or TNK, to achieve reperfusion in acute ischemic stroke patients presenting with thrombotic basilar artery occlusion before thrombectomy, compared to standard of care TPA or Alteplase. As many of our listeners are well aware, basilar artery occlusion represents one of the most severe forms of acute ischemic stroke, often resulting in devastating infarction of the brainstem and posterior circulation. And in the original Extend IA TNK trial published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2018, we saw that TNK achieved higher reperfusion rates and better functional outcomes compared to Alteplase for acute ischemic stroke presenting with proximal cerebral artery occlusions. And part of the data we're going to be talking about today is an extension of that original trial. The results of that study were featured in our August 7th, 2018 podcast with our colleague Kevin Baer interviewing the lead author at the time, Bruce Campbell. So with that, Fana, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be with you, Andy.
So just to get us all started with the major findings, Fana, would you mind just telling us what you found in this current study of TNK and stroke patients presenting with basilar artery occlusion?
Sure. Thanks, Andy. So basilar artery occlusion is a rare form of stroke. It accounts for approximately 1% of all strokes and 10% of strokes with large vessel occlusion. However, this is one of the most devastating neurological conditions associated with a high risk of disability and mortality, up to 70-80% if recanalization does not occur. Patients with this condition have been excluded from most of the trials showing the benefit of endovascular thrombectomy and intravenous thrombolysis in ischemic stroke. However, given the poor natural history of basilar artery occlusion, I strongly believe that we need to do more in this field. In our study, we wanted to investigate whether tenecteplase was associated with better reperfusion rates compared to Alteplase prior to endovascular therapy in patients with basilar artery occlusion. This is a retrospective analysis of consecutive patients with basilar artery occlusion from our prospective Bachman registry. Our primary outcome was reperfusion greater than 50% or absence of retrievable thrombus at the time of the initial angiogram, so prior to endovascular therapy. And we saw that reperfusion greater than 50% occurred in 26% of patients thrombolyzed with tenecteplase versus 7% of patients thrombolyzed with Alteplase, with no difference in the rate of symptomatic hemorrhage. So this study represents the largest series of tenecteplase-treated patients with basilar artery occlusion, and it's the first report of reperfusion rates with tenecteplase in patients with basilar artery occlusion.
Wow, Fana. So I just want to restate that primary finding for our audience. It sounds like that in this very large cohort of folks with basal artery occlusion, I think you said 110 patients, which is a large number given the rarity of this stroke presentation. It sounds like that 26% of the patients who received TNK had reperfusion of more than 50% of the artery compared to only, was it 7% of the patients with TPA? Did I get that right?
Yeah, that's correct, Andy.
Yeah, so it, as you noted, that would be a huge difference maker for thrombolysis as it relates to basal artery occlusion. One thing I do, you know, it would be worth talking about, Fana, briefly. While those of us in the stroke world are increasingly well-versed in the differences between TNK and TPA, the majority of our neurology audience may not be as familiar. Would you mind just talking a little bit about tenecteplase or TNK and why it may be a preferred thrombolytic agent to TPA and why it may, as you saw in the study, work better in reperfusing large vessel occlusions?
Sure, Andy. So tenecteplase is a genetically modified variant of alteplase with greater fibrin specificity and longer half-life that permits bolus administration. And this is the first huge advantage. So tenecteplase is given as a single 5-second intravenous bolus that requires approximately 2 minutes to prepare and being administered, whereas alteplase requires an hour infusion. And tenecteplase is cheaper than alteplase in most countries.
Thank you, Fana, for explaining some of those important details. Not only are there pharmacological properties that really make TNK appealing as a thrombolytic agent in regards to fibrin specificity and so forth, there really are some practical implications as well, as you noted, the single bolus dosing and route of administration. And then, you know, in the U.S., I'll point out as well, the cost compared to alteplase, which may be an important factor for smaller hospitals as well as larger hospitals alike. So Fana, I'm going to put you on the spot here with a $1 million question, because that's what our audience really wants to know. Do you feel these data and prior results of our TNK trials are enough today to recommend using it over alteplase, and particularly with patients who are presenting with large vessel occlusions?
It is a $1 million question, Andy. So I think there is enough evidence to recommend the use of tenecteplase 0.25 milligram per kilo in patients with large vessel occlusions based on the results of the extended 18K trial. For all other patients, there is evidence of non-inferiority of tenecteplase at either 0.25 milligram or 0.5 milligram compared to alteplase. So the Norwegian NORTEST trial published in 2017 compared tenecteplase 0.5 milligram to alteplase in 1,107 stroke patients and showed similar efficacy and safety to alteplase. The problem with this trial was that this was a very mild stroke population with a median NIH stroke scale of 4. So those kind of patients have a very good natural history, so it might be difficult to demonstrate the treatment effect between the two thrombolytic agents. There are ongoing trials, so it's really important to wait for these results. So stay tuned for this next trial as well.
Well, we certainly will, Fana, and good luck to you and Dr. Campbell and the group in Melbourne on this next trial that you're planning. I know that we'll all be looking forward to the results, and it stands to reason that we may see the tide shift fully with tenecteplase compared to alteplase here in the near future. So with that, I just want to encourage our listeners to seek out the full paper that we've been discussing on today's podcast, again, titled Tenecteplase versus Alteplase Before Endovascular Therapy and Basal Artery Occlusion in the Journal of Neurology. And I want to thank again, Fana, for your time and your work, and wish you all the best on your next endeavor.
Thanks very much, Andy.
Take care. Stay safe, all.
This is Jose Merino. Please check out this week's journal, which features an article covering how often patients with non-disabling ischemic stroke have MRI-defined targets for reperfusion therapy, and the study investigating the time course of a beta amyloid deposition in the brain. Please take a look at this and other weeks in this week's issue.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the Journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.